Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, Jonathan McNeil with the Neon Movies and curator of the LGBT Film Festival in Dayton. We'll talk about this year's festival selections. We'll also hit the road with producer Greg Tai and visit one of the world's last great places. We've got Politics Ohio and more coming your way. Up first, Community Voices producer Kristen Wicker takes us behind the scenes at The Signature, a poetic medley show now in its fifth season.
If you've been on a roller coaster before, I think that's how you would describe The Signature.
That was Lee Cross, CEO of Triple Cross Entertainment. What started in September 2000 as a record company for the poetic stylings of his wife, Sierra Leone, has morphed into a multifaceted production outfit. And its crown jewel is The Signature, an urban arts showcase held three times each season.
When you come in the door, it grabs you, it punches you in the mouth, and it keeps you down until, the very last whistle blows. I want it to be like a smorgasbord. I want it to be like when you go to Golden Corral or you go to the all-you-can-eat places. I want you to be so full and so entertaining and so overwhelmed and so happy that all you can do is just call it a night.
I met with a couple in their Fairborn home to talk about how The Signature came to be. I asked Sierra Leone what has changed since they launched the show in 2008.
I think the people and the community, they enjoyed us, and it was like, well, I'm going to enjoy you a little bit. And then after the finale, they kind of didn't want to show up to the finale because it was like, it's over, you know? And then when we came back, it was like, oh, you're back? And then so it was like year after year. So now in season five, it's just kind of like, when's the next show, you know?
Where's the sister? Sister Sierra in the place now. Y'all make some noise in the place.
Good evening. On behalf of Triple Cross Entertainment and the Human Rights Theater Company, we would like to welcome you to The Signature, a poetic medley show. We're so glad to have you here. 5 years and we're still standing.
Decided, hey, there are not a lot of stage shows for minority culture to attend. I think you got Tyler Perry, and then I think you got Tyler Perry. So once you get through with Tyler Perry stage shows for African Americans, you don't have a broad choice. And we wanted to bring something fresh, something new, something that really hadn't been done.
The couple also felt it was important to host such a show to support artists, creatively and financially. They wanted to create a vibrant, sustainable community for urban artists while bringing new and fresh talent to Dayton.
When I'm looking at urban creative arts, what I want most for it is for people to begin to value the art of poetry, because it's not value to some degree. People feel as if though you can call a poet and have them do a poem, and if they ask for money, you're thinking, you're supposed to starve, right? Aren't you a poet? Aren't you a starving artist? You know, I'm just thinking, well, you know, as we say, you know, our children don't, they don't eat thank yous. They eat SpongeBob snacks, you know?
Sisters in the house, if you can hear me say, hey.
When it comes to The Signature's future, the couple has big plans. Indeed, they hope one day to take The Signature to such cities as New York and Las Vegas and to the iconic Howard Theater in Washington, D.C.
We're not looking to be just here. We want to be able to take Dayton worldwide with The Signature. When everywhere we go, we represent Dayton. You know, we represent urban creative arts. We represent, that's what we do. No matter what, whenever you discuss it, whenever they talk about it, no matter what country, what language, they're going to have to say, that's from Dayton, Ohio. That's The Signature. It started there.
Romantic, really fantastic. Romantic, really fantastic.
Reporting for WISO, this is Community Voices producer Kristen Wicker.
HBO Def Jam poets Amir Suleiman and George Ami will headline the next installation of The Signature on Friday, September 28th from 9 to 11 p.m. at the Loft Theater in downtown Dayton. Hear more from Kristen Wicker and all of WISO's newest Community Voices producers on part two of our Community Voices special tonight at 6 and 11 p.m. on the Sunday Documentary Hour. You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks for joining us. And joining me in the studio this morning, Jonathan McNeil with The Neon in downtown Dayton. And we're going to talk about the LGBT Film Festival coming up September 28th through the 30th. It's an exciting weekend with a lot of movies coming your way. And Jonathan, first of all, talk about this event taking place for a number of years.
That's right. We're heading into our seventh year, actually. So we've looked at numerous films and a committee, actually, of about eight people who look at over 100 films to curate the weekend.
Now, eight people, this is something that you used to do on your own?
I used to do it 100% by myself. And then I realized that not only was it kind of too much work, but I also just wanted to have other people's voices into the curatorial process.
What were the challenges of getting that group together?
Well, it's really getting people committed to watching that much material, which really is time consuming. But it also allows me to the freedom of exploring things while they're watching films and letting kind of the great stuff surface. And then I can kind of take a look at the cream of the crop and make some decisions along with them for the festival. This year, I really think, is a spectacular lineup. I really think it's our best yet.
Well, I know the festival really has gotten into the heart of people in downtown Dayton. I want to talk about who is coming to the film festival, the audience that you've seen over the last 7 years.
Well, certainly we reach out to the LGBT community in and around Dayton, and even as far away as Cincinnati and Columbus. And, you know, we certainly see those people coming out en masse. But we want to make sure that people realize that it's not just for the LGBT community. It's certainly a festival that is, you know, the stories focus on the experiences and lives of people in that community. But anyone who appreciates good cinema certainly will get something from these films. You know, it's quite possible that one of these films could go on to be nominated for Academy Awards. And a lot of times people ask us, how do you get to see all these films? And a lot of times it's festivals. We played a short a few years ago called Freeheld, which ended up being nominated for Best Documentary Short. And if you didn't see it at the festival, you had to wait a couple years before it was available on DVD. So
let's talk about the films that are coming up this year.
Okay. Well, I'll talk about the final film first. The final film is Ira Sachs's film called Keep the Lights On. Just a great story in the New York Times recently about that. It premiered at Sundance this year. It won the Teddy Award at the Berlin Film Festival this year. Just been doing incredible things, including opening in Paris recently, where it had a great response there, both from the press and from audiences, saying it's one of the best American films of the year. So we're really delighted to have that as our closing film.
Marion's Pizza sponsoring this film. And tell me a little bit about the importance of sponsors.
Well, what we do is we get a sponsor to help us pay for the films. They pay for the films outright, but there are a lot of additional expenses that come along with the festival. So ticket prices certainly don't pay for the festival. Our festival will end up costing about $12,000 to really make the whole thing happen between marketing and shipping and handling and the films themselves. So the after party. So finding those sponsors not only helps to make the cost more attainable for us, but also getting somebody associated with each of those films helps with outreach as well. So suddenly, you know, eight films curated over the course of a weekend by a different company, that's eight different companies who have a vested interest in the festival doing well.
Great. What else is on tap?
Opening night is Gaby, which is a film about a gay man and his straight best friend, and she wants to have a baby, and she wants to do it naturally. And it's a comedy. It's so hard to find a really smart, fresh comedy. So often comedies tend to be kind of simplistic and silly. This one is really refreshingly smart and well done. And we're bringing the director of that film as well, Jonathan Lasecki, will be coming with the festival. So that's our opening night on Friday, September 28th.
Great. So folks will have a chance to meet him?
That's right. If you come to the opening night of the festival, you get into the opening party, which is on the top floor of the Crown Plaza. So if you have a pass to the festival or a ticket to that film in particular, you get into the party. There'll be free cocktails, appetizers, photo booth, DJ. So it'll be a fun night there. A really terrific film called How to Survive a Plague. It is a documentary about ACT UP in the 80s and what they did to really make changes politically for people living with HIV.
And, of course, ACT UP, known for doing some acting up, but
the
situation called for it. You had a whole society of people that needed to be shaken into awareness.
And they really made not only politicians start to do things because they weren't doing anything in the 80s for people with HIV, but also made Wall Street pay attention and pharmaceutical companies and whatnot started to realize that they needed to make changes as well. And it was due to their radical practices, throwing ashes on the White House lawn, those kinds of things that really made people start to pay attention.
You also, once again, are premiering Top Drawer Shorts, which I know is a favorite for many.
It's a great collection of shorts. I mean, we look at films from all around the world to curate this program. And, you know, today I just was wiring money to Germany and to Spain to pay for some of the rights for these films. So it's really an international, wonderful collection of shorts.
And when you're dealing with international firms and trying to bring their movies here, doesn't that give Dayton, Ohio a presence?
It does. I mean, we have a lot of filmmakers who now are coming to us with their films as opposed to us reaching out and asking filmmakers, you know, can we take a look at your work? We now have some filmmakers who are coming to us saying, we've heard great things about your festival. Will you please take a look at my work? So that's a really great place to be in. I also want to mention another feature, Cloudburst. It's the Saturday night kind of centerpiece of the festival. It is a huge, huge audience pleaser. It's been winning audience awards at film festivals all around the country. It's Olympia Dukakis and Brenda Fricker as aging lesbians on a road trip to Canada in order to get legally married. And people are really loving it.
And again, that is Saturday at 7 o'clock.
That's right. Cloudburst at 7. And then I Want Your Love at the Night Spot starting at 9:30. And that is a film by Travis Matthews. You do have to be 18 to get into the screening. There's due to explicit content. He will be coming to the festival as well. And really interesting director who is now working with James Franco on his next project.
It's described as a rare insight into the uncensored lives of a generation of gay men. Let's talk a little bit about that.
Well, it's very sexually explicit, but it's also told in a way where the story takes precedence. It's about someone who's about to leave town and their friends kind of rallying around to bid him farewell and his kind of encounters with people that he loves before he leaves. And it's just really raw and honest. And it's a very small story, but it really resonates as being true to a lot of gay men. So that one, you know, we're excited to bring the director, excited to know that he's really moving along. And, you know, because of this film, you know, got the Franco camp interested in bringing him on board for Franco's new project, which is interestingly a reimagining of the lost 40 minutes of Cruising, which was a pinnacle film of the gay film movement with Al Pacino years ago.
Right. So that brings us to Sunday. And let's talk about the final day of the festival. We've talked about the closing film, Keep the Lights On, but also you're going to run Love Free or Die.
Right. And that is a film on Sunday afternoon at 1 o'clock, which is about Gene Robinson, who was the first openly gay bishop in all of Christendom. He actually had to wear a bulletproof vest to his indoctrination and has daily death threats. So really an interesting piece. It's really a portrait about him. But in being a portrait about him, it's a lot about Christianity and their take on homosexuality and his in particular, and how he really thinks that Christianity has gotten a bad rap and has really gotten it wrong. And, you know, this year was particularly hard for us in curating the festival because there was so much great work. And there were actually a couple films about religion and homosexuality and their cross. Another one we looked at was called Seventh Gay Adventists. And we're looking to maybe if this festival goes well this year, we might start doing a quarterly series where we just once every few months bring a film in that we thought also could have played in the festival, but just to do as a special event. So that's something we might bring down the road as well.
Also, you have the middle showing on Sunday.
Right. Sunday at 3 o'clock is Mezquita y Mari, which is a film about some Latinas, young Latinas in L.A., and just a really, really wonderfully done story about a coming-of-age story of young lesbians.
The LGBT Film Festival coming up September 28th through the 30th. It kicks off on Friday night on the 28th at 7:30 with the premiere of Gaby, and then there's an after party. We can get more information at the website.
Right, and the website is DaytonLGBT.com.
Jonathan McNeil with The Neon in downtown Dayton. Thank you.
Right, thank you.
This is WISO Weekend on WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks for joining us. It's time for another road trip. This week, producer Greg Tye takes us to a place in northern Ohio that the Nature Conservancy has called one of the world's last great places.
Just west of Toledo is the Oak Openings Metro Park, a 4,000-acre site that preserves an amazing ecosystem.
The Oak Openings, to the untrained eye, looks an awful lot like a regular oak forest. The beauty of the Oak Openings is up close. It's not the first glance that gets you. It's the second and the third and the fourth that draws you in.
Nature photographer Art Weber says the Oak Openings region is a blending of habitats that developed on sand deposited during the last ice age.
What we have is a layer of sand overlaying clay. And where it's thick, it's very, very dry. And wherever the sand is thin, it becomes very wet. This occurs all over the Oak Openings, and as a result, you have all these habitats very close together, many of them supporting special animals, special plants, and as a result, we have many, many rare species here.
It is the epicenter of biodiversity in the state of Ohio, without a doubt.
Bob Jaxey is a naturalist with Metroparks of the Toledo area.
There's more endangered species of plants here than anywhere in the state of Ohio. A greater variety of nesting songbirds and greater variety of butterflies than anywhere in the state of Ohio, including the federally endangered Connor blue butterfly.
On the one hand, you have many rare species, which makes it special, but you also have lots of species that occur in different habitats that are very close together, so that's unusual, too. It's kind of forest, but it's not. And the openings are kind of prairie, but they're not. So what you have is this mixing and mingling of the eastern hardwood forest with the prairies of the west.
The Oak Openings region is actually a mosaic collection of distinctly different habitats coexisting within a small area, and most easily seen at the Girdham Road sand dunes.
This is Ohio's biggest living sand dune, and by living, I mean it's dynamic. The wind is still sculpting it, and it's pushing the sand at about 3 feet a year towards the east, towards Toledo.
The sand dunes here are very, very dry, tough, sunny conditions, very harsh conditions. You go down a slope, down the other side of the dunes, into a very cool, wet area. You can find salamanders, amphibians that rely on a lot of water.
We have oak openings like we're looking at right now. We have pin oak flatwoods, which is a more wet habitat, where the dominant tree is pin oak rather than the white and black oak that we're seeing here. And we've got grasslands. We look about half a mile away, we can see the prairie grasses, just acres and acres of prairie grasses.
There are other openings here that are wet sand prairies, and those are even more rare globally. Nature Conservancy keeps track of things like this, and they look at habitats all over the world. And they've called it one of the world's last great places, which puts it on a par with the Everglades and the Pacific temperate rainforest and some of the rarest habitats on Earth, because it is one of the rarest habitats on Earth.
It has every bit the grandeur of the Everglades or Yellowstone. The difference is it's smaller, but it's every bit as interesting. You could spend many lifetimes exploring this place and never get tired of it.
The Kitty Todd, Irwin Prairie, and Lou Campbell State Nature Preserves are also located nearby to protect more of this amazing ecosystem. From the Oak Openings region outside Toledo, I'm Greg Tye.
You can download the new Ohio Guide Tours at seeohiofirst.org. The new Ohio Guide is produced by the Ohio Humanities Council, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. In the summer of 1908, Wilbur Wright astonished the world, demonstrating the Wright Flyer in France. No one had ever flown as long and with such control. The world took notice. Back here in the States that same summer, Orville Wright was making demonstration flights, too, for the U.S. Army's Signal Corps, trying to get a contract to sell planes to the U.S. government. Dayton aviation historian and photographer Dan Patterson tells the story.
The Signal Corps required that the plane be able to fly 40 miles an hour. The engine had to perform without a miss. There would have to be a cross-country demonstration, and the plane had to be able to carry a passenger. Orville would fly a plane identical to what Wilbur was flying in France, and he traveled to Fort Myer in Virginia, an army post just across the river from Washington, D.C., to demonstrate. He arrived by train on August 20th and went to work assembling the plane with his mechanics, complaining in letters to his sister and brother that he couldn't get any work done. "I have to give my time to answering the 10,000 fool questions people ask about the machine," he said. But finally, on September 3rd, he took to the air, flying slow, easy circles over the Army parade ground and the western edge of Arlington Cemetery. At first, the public paid very little attention. The Washington Evening Star carried the news on page 3. But as Orville flew day after day, longer and higher, with two different passengers, word got out. The crowds grew. On September 9th, he broke the records Wilbur had set in France that summer. On September 17, Orville was to take up a Signal Corps officer, Lieutenant Thomas Selfridge. Orville said he didn't trust him an inch. He was a supporter of the Wrights' keenest rival, Glenn Curtiss. They started the engine. Selfridge took off his jacket and hat. Orville wore a suit as usual. The flyer left the ground and was flying just fine. They made three circles of the parade ground when Orville heard a tapping sound and decided to land. But the tapping became loud knocks, and the flight controls betrayed him. He cut the engine and struggled with the flyer, which was weaving back and forth, before it plunged almost straight down. Orville said later, and observers confirmed, the flyer was just about to pull out, but ran out of air. It struck the ground very hard. Selfridge suffered a skull fracture. Orville's leg was broken. Selfridge died that night. In France, Wilbur was preparing to fly when he received a telegram about the crash. He was mortified and blamed himself for not being there to help his brother. He understood how Orville could have been distracted and not paid proper attention to the assembly of the plane. A man cannot take sufficient care when he is subject to continual interruptions and his time is consumed in talking to visitors, he wrote to his sister as she stayed at Orville's side. But the Signal Corps was satisfied. Orville had exceeded their requirements, and they invited him to return with a new plane once he was healed. The following summer, the city of Dayton held a huge celebration to honor the Wrights with parades, band concerts, and fireworks. The next morning, the brothers boarded a train for Fort Myer together to finish the job Orville had begun. For WYSO, this is Dan Patterson wishing you blue skies and tailwinds.
Now when this is over, over and through, and all them changes have come and passed, I wanna meet you in the big sky country. I just wanna prove, mama, love can last, yeah. Like hallelujah in the big sky country, just like forever and ever is wild. Let me tell you why. 'Cause you held my number, You held my name. You held my body through the thick and thin. On a bed of roses in the big sky country. I spread out to love you. Love you in your second skin. Like a hallelujah in the big sky.
Welcome to Politics Ohio. I'm Emily McCord. Another big week on the campaign trail this week. President Obama stopped in Cincinnati, and next week, Republican challenger Mitt Romney and his running mate Paul Ryan will visit the state. BBC reporter and the anchor of BBC World Update, Dan Damon, has been in Ohio this week covering the news, and he's with us today. Thanks for being here.
Emily, it's great to talk to you.
So certainly a lot of the nation looks to Ohio as the election approaches, but can you tell me how carefully does the international community look to the state?
Those who are interested in American politics, and there are a lot of people. My professor, when I was doing my political science degree, said that everyone in the world should have a vote in the U.S. election because what the U.S. does affects everybody in the world. And certainly we know that the election counts, and we know that there are some states that you have to watch. And I think most people who do take an interest would know that Ohio really is pretty high up the top of that list.
There are two sort of narratives when we're talking about the election going on, particularly about the economy right now, and that kind of depends on what party you subscribe to. If you're a Republican, it's that Obama isn't getting the job done to set our economy straight. The Democrats are saying, hey, we inherited this and we're better off than we were 4 years ago. When you're talking to folks in Ohio this week, what message is resounding most?
I certainly found that the idea that the Obama administration had failed on the economy wasn't the common currency that I kind of expected. And I think that has changed even in the week that I've been here. Indeed, the opinion polls show that, don't they, Emily, that people are beginning to say they trust President Obama a bit more than Mitt Romney on the economy. Now, what opinion polls tell you about the real opinions before people actually get inside and they pull the lever or they make their mark, I don't really know. But certainly the idea that President Obama had spent all the money and there'd been no good to come of it, I think that really seems to have lost a lot of its power in the past few days. Of course, the debates are coming. Mitt Romney does have a history as a successful businessman. He may be able to pull that round.
You did also speak to Republicans this week, and Mitt Romney has had a tough week on the campaign trail, most recently because of that fundraising video where he seemingly dismissed 47% of the country. How do Republicans feel about the state of the Republican campaign right now?
I went to Cuyahoga County, to one of the victory centers, as they call them there. Of course, talking to me, a reporter, they're going to be optimistic. They're going to say, yeah, we're going to win. One guy said, it's going to be a landslide. And then he paused and said, but that might be wishful thinking. On the 47%, of course, a lot of the people who were at the phone bank that I went to see, they're in the 47%. They're either retired or they're getting supports of all different kinds from the federal or from the state government. I think what Mitt Romney said was clearly misspoken, and you can tell that from the number of Republicans around the country who have been kind of distancing themselves at a rapid pace. But on the other hand, I think he did the right thing by not just saying, oh, sorry. I think the point he's trying to make, which is one that is being made in the political climate in Europe as well, is that there are too many people who are dependent on handouts. No, you couldn't dismiss them. You shouldn't dismiss them. And I think that was the mistake. You know, they're not doing it because they just want to sit around watching daytime TV. So whether Mitt Romney, by doubling down, as you say, on those comments, can get that message across, I'm not sure. I don't see him relating to people. When you see him working a crowd, it just doesn't feel right. Where I saw President Obama working the crowd in Cincinnati, you just know he's connecting. They're really there with him. But the point needs to be made. A sensible and grown-up debate has to be had about how many people are actually reliant on money, which I think everybody would probably agree the country can't afford all that.
Just shifting gears here for a moment, do you get the impression that foreign policy is important to Ohioans as an election issue?
It is in terms of trade. I learned that from one of the people I spoke to this week. And of course, there are a great many military families around Ohio, and they know the sharp end of foreign policy. And the issue of America abroad and its reputation, the security of its personnel, the people who are out there trying to create change, and the world would be, I would say, a worse place if it wasn't for the Americans who are willing to go out and work on aid programs, to work as diplomats. In terms of the big issues at this time, America's pulling back from its defense commitments in the Middle East, in Afghanistan, and that's certainly going to change the economics inside this country. And the level of change, the pace of change in the Middle East at the moment, nobody really knows where that's going. So I've had some of those conversations. But of course, as you know, Emily, you know, it's the economy, it's jobs, and it's the character of the candidates. That's what really counts when the vote comes on the 6th of November.
I've been speaking with Dan Damon from the BBC. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Pleasure, Emily.
That's it for this week's edition of WISO Weekend. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks to all our guests, and thank you for listening to member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at wyso.org, a broadcast service of Antioch University for the Miami Valley. Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook.